Happy Shabbat, everyone, as we move within less than a week's time now of Pesach and Matzah and Bukurim. My pleasure to be with you. It looks like by the skin of his teeth, we have the Larianator. James, you've been here early, and Kirk even before James. It's my pleasure to welcome all of you guys. How are you doing?
Good evening.
Doing
good.
Good
evening. What I originally thought we might do to this evening, and I would if we weren't on the cusp of Pesach, is delve into the comments that were shared by Roy, and I think there'll be another time that's better suited for that. And I think all of those of us who have listened to the program that he did on Shattering Myths have been enlightened by it. But since we are on the eve of Pesach, you know, it's pretty hard not to to turn to what God had to say and just reestablish our understanding of what these days mean. And what I would like to do is just begin with a quick overview. You know, we've had a lot of discussions here recently about this, that, and the other thing regarding what does us the most good? What did Yahweh have in mind when he provided his Torah guidance? Was it for us to do what he said, or was it for us to understand what he said? And I would like everyone to think about that in light of what we would gain from Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim if we did what he said versus what we gain from them if we understand what he said.
Well, I'm on the understand end of it over here. You know, it's it seems pretty clear to me that the reason he had all these directions and instructions is so we would learn, so we could understand him, his nature, and his offer. And beyond that, there isn't much else to glean. I mean, you know, that's where we're at.
Yeah, I'm quite convinced, Larry, that if you were to perfectly time the arrival of the Pesach lamb into your home, and you were to introduce it to the family, and it were to be there for 4 days, and you were to butcher it in exactly the manner that Yahweh had prescribed, and your hands were placed exactly as he asked that our hands be placed, and you were to drain of it of its blood in perfect accordance with the Torah's instructions in that regard, and then you were to discard the portions that Yahweh wanted discarded, later be burned up in the fire, and you were to cook over a grill the portions that Yahweh intended, and you were to serve it to your family at the perfect time, and you were to mix it with matzah and bitter herbs, and you were to eat it with your family and share it with other families in need, and that that evening you were to burn up the remainder of the lamb, and you were to remove all yeast from your home and eat un-yeasted bread for 7 days and celebrate Bukurim with a wave offering of perfect
in the end,
proportions.
If you didn't understand it, what would it mean?
What would it gain?
I don't think you'd gain anything. Personally, I don't think you would gain anything. I think it would be an absolute waste of your time. Now, that's pretty strong. Now, that's way even past Larry in saying that the understanding is vastly more important than the doing. But I'm telling you that it's my view that if you were to do these three things and not know what they represented and not capitalize on what they represent, you'd be wasting your time.
The only benefit of doing them is that they serve as a teaching tool. They help you to come to understand.
Correct.
Me and Patty talked about when we have kids, we're going to try and keep as much of it as accurate as we can, not out of a ritualistic sense.
Right.
So as we're walking through it, we can explain step by step to our kids what we're doing and why.
Correct.
To me, that's the greatest benefit from doing it.
Yeah.
I think, for us
that don't have young kids around, it, rather than for around young children and for people that don't understand, it's a great teaching tool. For those of us who may be doing it with Yahweh, just, you know, by our lonesome with Yahweh, which is, you know, really good company. I look at it more as a just a time of celebration. It's just we're just going to have a party together, just be the two of us. We're going to have a fine time in this party, just the two of us. And I look at all of it and do all of it just because it's fun to do stuff together that with Yahweh that Yahweh likes. I like that.
You know, there was an email that I took part in here, you know, just giving some answers, where a fella, I think it was with William, I can't remember who was doing the email. A lot of times I don't know because I'm so poor with tech, but I think it was William. And there was somebody making the statement that, okay, if it's the Torah that saves, then what happened with, you know, Abraham? The Torah hadn't been written. And my answer to that's real simple. Then you look at Torah as a bunch of laws and do's and don'ts, when Torah is just simply paying attention to what Yahweh says and trusting in Him. It's His instructions and teachings.
Well, we're told that instructions, Abraham did have the Torah.
That's because Torah doesn't mean.
Correct.
But that's because Torah could not mean a bunch of laws.
Correct.
To do.
It
means teachings and instructions, which He listened to.
Yeah, you're both saying exactly the same thing. It is true.
Yeah.
Yahweh said that he gave His Torah to Abraham. Just as when He returns on Yom Kippurim, He's going to give His Torah to us. But that ain't the Torah that we're reading from and we're going to read from today. That's
right.
And
that, but
teaching
see,
and guidance.
That statement alone to Abraham proves that the Torah does not mean a bunch of laws to follow.
Correct.
Period.
As a matter of fact, salvation is a derivative of the covenant. All the Torah does is introduce you to the author of the covenant, the father of the covenant, the terms and conditions of the covenant, and the benefit of the covenant. The Torah does not exist for any other reason than to explain the covenant to us. So if Yahweh provided His guidance, His Torah, to Abraham regarding the covenant, which He clearly did, why would He need any more Torah than that?
No, He accepted it with very little information compared to what we have.
Well, but he was given a lot more information in some ways than we were.
Well, that's true. But
Had the express ride to the spiritual realm of the stars and seen the light of the stars and understood the dimensions beyond three.
No. No. He walked out of Babylon with a lot less than you and I did.
You betcha. Absolutely. And Yahweh was a lot better known to us than He was to Abraham, even though Abraham met with Him personally. He's much better known to us. But this is absolutely true. So that is the Christian argument. That's Paul's argument. I mean, if you get right down to it, in Galatians, he bases his attack on the Torah and his advocacy of faith based upon this idea that since the Torah didn't exist at the time of Abraham, Abraham had to be saved through faith. That's Paul's justification, and that's what this... Really, I mean, this was a lost cause, this idiot that was corresponding with William. William's not a lost cause. William's a wonderful guy. But the guy that he was trying to reach was a lost cause. In fact, the man went so far as to say that Moshe didn't know that he was writing Scripture. He didn't know that he would be shocked if he were to find that people were viewing what he wrote as Scripture.
He's taking it word for word from the Creator's mouth to His hand. And
on a burning mountaintop.
As were every one of the prophets. I mean, the guy was a boo. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, he was a boo.
But
didn't know when God said, write
Paul's
this
argument,
down, that, that's Scripture.
When you get right to the heart of it, and you recognize how foolish Paul's argument is, then you really come to understand what the Torah is all about. The Torah isn't the means to salvation in that regard. The Torah is the means to know Yahweh and to understand the covenant. It's the means to guide us to the covenant. And the covenant is the means to relationship, and in that relationship, a byproduct of it is that we're saved. And these seven invitations to meet with God are all the means that God provided for him to honor the benefits of the covenant. And so is the Torah saving us, or is Yahweh saving us by the directions and commitments that he has offered to his children? I'd say that the Torah exists to explain the covenant, and in the covenant, Yahweh does wonderful things for his children, and one of them is to save them.
Well, if it's a contract, both parties have to do their bit. I mean, all we have in the contract is this is what we're planning to do. I'm going to do this. You're going to do that. You can sign the dotted line, but you still have to perform.
Right.
So the document is just that.
Yeah, and just think about what Paul said about the covenant memorialized in the Torah, where he said it was of Hagar and its slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And so how in the world would Abraham be saved if the covenant that he formed with Yahweh wasn't with Sarah, but was with Hagar, and that it enslaved him? He couldn't be saved, could he?
No.
So it would be impossible, if you use Paul's thought process, for Abraham to be saved.
Well, the first statement, like you talked about this morning, that blows that away. You cannot be.
Yes.
He's not talking enslavement. He's talking about freedom. So.
Right. Yes, I think it is, and it wasn't until this morning, Kirk, that this dawned on me, so I'm a slow learner. But how profound it is that Yahweh's first request to Abraham, which is to walk away from Babylon, is mirrored from a slightly different perspective in the first statement he makes on the first of those two tablets. After introducing himself, I am Yahweh, your Almighty. I have delivered you from slavery in Mitzrayim. And so what he is saying here, if you put the two together, which is what Yahweh wants us to do, you only can understand by making connections. That's the only way to understand. You put the two together. Yahweh's not asking us to walk away from human, religious, and political and military constructs alone. He's saying, I'm going to be there with you. I'll walk with you. I'll hand in hand, I'll lead you away from this. I'll provide the very substance you need to walk away from it so that you're not walking away floundering and isolated, but walking away in the core of my family. So, you know, I'll focus on you. I'll provide
just the
foundation. Go ahead.
You know, there's also a point where Yahweh talks to the clerics, you know, the Hebrew clerics at the time, about their Torah. Huh.
Right.
And he says their Torah kills people. It corrupts the whole foundation of the covenant. That's what he says.
Right.
So if Torah really meant a bunch of laws and this and that, Yahweh wouldn't be calling the teachings and instructions of the clerics Torah. Now, would he?
No.
But that's exactly the word he uses, isn't it?
But he calls, you know, the rabbis, they say they have their oral Torah, and that they're Torah observant because they're following their oral Torah, which is now memorialized in the Jerusalem
Talmud.
And Babylonian Talmud. Now, mind you, that they would be 2,000 years late. So it took them 2,000 years to record what was they allegedly passed on orally. But the use of Torah is absolutely correct, Larry, because it is the religious guidance and instruction that is the basis
Noah,
of Judaism.
Did Noah follow Yahweh's Torah? Well, sure he did. He followed the instructions. He built the ark.
Correct.
And here's what it says. As for yourselves, you have turned from the way, causing many to stumble by your instructions and teachings. And right there it says, that's Torah.
Right.
So the directions of the clerics, I mean, besides being, you know, totally misguided, the word Torah, for anybody who's calling it law, as in Yahweh's got a bunch of laws to follow, you know, they really need to wake up, because that's not what the word Torah means. I mean, we go through this all the time, say, okay, Toh and Yara and, you know, everything, Tob and all that, because it means that. This is not just us saying it. It's actually thoughtful. Right. And until people get into the actual meanings of real words that have real meanings, you know, they need to keep their mouths shut about a subject they know nothing of, because that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that Kirk, Larry, in this regard, slowed us down to speed up our understanding. And what I mean by that is by taking the time to consider every word based upon the yods and tittles of those words, and thoughtfully appreciating the illustrations that Yahweh has made, that process is slow, but it speeds up your understanding, because now the words, each individual word, resonates. It draws a picture. It helps us understand what he is saying. And, you know, it's, I want to make this point, it's probably super redundant. Yahweh defines the words that he chooses to use. If it's an important word, he defines his term. Yahweh tells us that Torah is based upon the verb yara, and there is no dispute as to what yara means. It is the source from which guidance, direction, instruction, and teaching flows. That's what it means.
Right. Yeah, yeah, and it's amazing to me. It's astounding if people really thought about this. If Abraham followed his Torah before it was written, then it's got to be more than just what was written. It means his instructions.
Where was the covenant affirmed? Where was the covenant affirmed?
On Mount Moriah.
And Mount Moriah is the center of what city?
Jerusalem, which means the place where all...
Before we get there, the first four Mikrae, what city were they affirmed in?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem.
All right. What city did Yahusha spend most of his time?
Jerusalem.
What city was he in when he gave his Olivet discourse, the Mount of Olives?
Oh, yeah, same place.
Jerusalem. Same place, right? Same place. So when that city means what, Larry? What's the name of that city?
Well, it's the place from which all teaching and instruction for salvation come.
Right.
You know? Sure.
Actually, it's salvation is an acceptable translation of shalom. It's not the most direct, it's an indirect translation of shalom. Just like peace is an indirect translation of shalom. It's not incorrect, it's just indirect. The most direct translation of shalom is reconciliation. And you might say, you know, what's the big deal? Well, there is a big deal. And the big deal is, Yahweh's intent is not to save us. Yahweh's intent is to get to know us and form a relationship with us and enjoy our company.
Yeah, if he wanted to save everybody in the world, he could.
Of course.
It's as simple as that.
That's right. But that's not his intent. His intent is to form a relationship with us, to have us become part of his family. When we're part of his family, he does the fatherly thing and saves us. But it's a byproduct.
Yeah, you're right.
That's
it's shalom.
Shalom.
That's right. That's why it's
Yarusalom. It's not Yarusayara, you know.
I hear you.
Right.
You're right.
Now, it is true
there because
that
it's necessary for the relationship. Our relationship needs to be reconciled. That's the only reason Yah has any interest in reconciliation.
There is a day
but when Yah was
necessary for the relationship.
Yeah.
Even
there
when Yah was talking to the people that he says he's going to keep out of the great, what he called the great calamity, he talks about shalom. You know, they're going to be in a perfect situation. Yeah. That's the word he uses.
There is one day a year that Yahweh speaks of reconciling his relationship. Well, what day would that be?
Yom Kippurim.
Yom Kippurim. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's Yom Kippurim. When Yahweh fulfills Yom Kippurim, and he reconciles his relationship with Yisrael and Yehuda, where is he going to do that?
In Jerusalem.
Jerusalem.
Do you think that's a coincidence?
No.
No, I don't.
No,
I mean, you really got to overlook a lot of words. There are so many people out there today, and I'm glad you brought this up. It's important, and I know we're on talking about the Mikra, and that is a fulfillment of a very, the most the awesome day, you know, the corporeal day.
Right.
And yet there are tons of people that are worried about who the real Jews are, and they claim they're everywhere but Jerusalem. And of course, I got some bad news for him, because when he returns, it's the people in Jerusalem he's talking to.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 2/3 of them may be dead by then, and that
right.
that will be true.
But the vast majority of Jews who are alive on the earth, the overwhelming preponderance will be in Israel.
That's right.
At that time. Right.
And he calls them family. So if
yes.
you're going to be family to Yahweh and claim that you can, you know, you are the real Jew and you're, you know, somewhere else in the world, it doesn't mean a real Jew can't be in America right now. They are a real Jew, you know, down in the Caribbean. But it does mean that the people that Yahweh called back to his land in this last generation
are the Jews.
Are the people there. They're called
right.
Jews.
Right. They're not in Texas.
Yeah, I'm
they're
amazed.
Not,
that,
you know, they're
the
not
amount
United
of people
States.
That,
they're in Israel.
They talk about they take a verse where he talks about false Jews and their synagogues and what have you, and they just blow it completely out of proportion. You know,
yeah. Take one statement out of context and
run with it. Well, that you know, the false Jews and their synagogues, if I'm not mistaken, is a comment relative to the assembly of Ephesus when Yosha is writing his open letter through Yahochanan, and the false the phonies he's talking about are Shaul, Paul, and his pals.
Yeah, that's one of the two places. The other place it talks about it is in Revelation. I don't have it pulled up.
Yeah,
I did
yeah. But I'm talking about Revelation. That's what I'm mentioning is Revelation 3. Now, maybe other places, but yeah, it's Yahweh talks about the false Jews and the most false, most phony of all Jews was Paul. It doesn't get any phonier than that. Now, we are actually talking about Pesach Bukurim and Pesach Matzen Bukurim when we talk about Jerusalem and what Jerusalem means, because it is the place where it was demonstrated to us. And I am surprised, I guess, that there are so few places on earth today where people are celebrating the meaning of these 7 days. Now, you guys may do more searching than I do, but are you aware of any other place than kind of our family here with Yahweh where Pesach is celebrated not as a historic event, but instead as the doorway to eternal life?
I don't know if there's one.
Yeah, that's scary that it's so is mostly us.
Yes. And that Matzah is not celebrated as a historical event where, you know, they were hurrying out of Egypt as slaves before Pharaoh changed his mind, but instead, as if God would have a challenge with that, but instead, as Yosha explained it, which is the removal of political and religious sin. Where else? I mean, Yosha is one of the most profound things he said. He said, you know, to his disciples, why are you guys grumbling about not having brought loaves of bread? If I wanted bread, didn't I feed the multitudes? I mean, I just make bread if I wanted bread. I'm trying to explain to you what the yeast represents. And yet, I don't think there is, I've never heard anybody make that distinction. And
yeah, and the yeast puffs people up, speaking of Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you look at Bukurim. You know, I've referred to it here and there as first fruits, and it can mean first fruits, but its most direct translation is firstborn children. And equates firstborn children to Yosha being born anew of spirit post his matzah separation. Where else is that explained? Now, I'm not saying this because I think we deserve any credit. I'm saying this because it seems to me that the connections are easy to make. It seems to me that if you go in open-minded and you read what Yahweh had to say about these dates and his fulfillment of these dates and the agony that he went through to honor his promises regarding these dates and their correlation to the five benefits of the covenant, that if you make those connections, it's an extraordinarily important and easy understanding to obtain. So why is the world so ignorant about this? I would be surprised if there were more than a few thousand people in the world that understood what these days represent.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if there were more than a couple thousand people in the world that understood, okay, here's the foreshadowing and here's the fulfillment and here is when the last three are going to be fulfilled. I've got notes on those. It just shows you. And,
right.
You know, you have the dress rehearsal, then you have the actual fulfillment. And you're right, there's very few people that know this because there's very few people that are willing to spend the time to get to know it. And even many people that say they want to spend time, you know, they're sitting there with religious material.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my opinion, religious material is misleading. It's misleading on purpose.
Yeah.
Many of them will tell you can still figure out the truth with it. And my answer to that is no, you can't.
No, you can't.
I don't believe
those
you can.
Those people have no interest in the truth. Those people are just looking to have their belief reinforced.
Yeah,
look, let me give you a great example. For years, I wrote side by side with Ken Power. We were very, very good friends. And occasionally, Ken would come up with an insight, and I would jump all over it and expand on it and verify it and then come up with all sorts of related insights that could be gleaned from it. And then it became a time where I was, by studying Yahweh's testimony, just deluged with insights as to what God was telling us. And it was easy. I mean, you just spend the time, and they come naturally because God tells them to us. All we have to do is make the connections. And almost all of my learning came directly from caring about what the words meant, taking each word, removing the religious interpretations, and getting right to its root, and what does the word mean? And when I did that, all of a sudden, there was this enormous amount of understanding that became available. And somewhere along the way, I lost Ken. Because Ken wanted to continue to use the New King James and the New Living Translation. And so he continued, he read the what he would call the Bible from cover to cover over and over again. And then he would go through and make little lists of put passages in various files to talk about, but always translated in the New Living Translation and the New King James. And so here's a wonderful man, a nice man, that genuinely wanted to know, that spent his time with religious material and was lost somewhere along the way. I agree with you. I don't care how diligent you are. If you're going to rely on the religious material, the religious translations, you're not going to get there. I don't think it's even possible.
When Ken was confronted with the thousands and thousands of erroneous translations, it had no effect on
him? It was almost a pushback.
It was kind of pushback
on saying, you know, you're making a religion out of the words.
Hmm.
You know, you're no longer able to communicate.
Well,
I'm here to tell you, Roy was a pretty smart guy, wouldn't you agree? The atheist?
Yeah.
Turned covenant member. Pretty smart guy. Larry, you're a pretty aggressive guy, aren't you? Pretty feisty.
Yeah.
Right?
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kirk, you're pretty much is kind of down to earth and, you know, level headed, down to earth guy as they come. And JB, you're well schooled. In fact, you work in a school district, right? technology yeah. school district.
Right. I'm the dummy of the group.
Oh no, we're not even talking about processing speed here. We're just talking about you're well educated and you work in a school district in technology, correct? So you're a thinking guy. You were previously an agnostic, correct?
Correct.
Kirk, you were previously a Christian.
I went through not having anything to do with the church till I finally had to pick something, and then I finally got away.
And the smartest guy that I know, by the way, I just want to talk about smart. The smartest guy I know is Yoel.
Yeah.
Every one of you came to know Yahweh because I shared the translations that of his word, where I became fascinated by what he had to say. Very different backgrounds, very different people, very different personalities. So a fixation on what the words actually meant, his words, when you're fixated on really trying to understand what his words mean, resonates with a pretty significant cross-section of people. Mm-hmm. Yahweh had no problem communicating with any of you, did he?
No.
Nope.
Not at all.
Yeah, I was a very effective communicator, and to suggest that if you are diligent and you try to translate his words as accurately and completely as possible, that somehow you're going to fail to communicate, is to say that the creator of life and the universe can only communicate if we help him.
He needs man.
And if we use the King's English. When I see those flowery prose written down and people are saying this is Yahweh's words, oh, gag me. He doesn't even sound like that. It's just such nonsense.
No, Yahweh's very straightforward, and he's got a wonderful language to communicate his message in. And it's profound. And ultimately, if I'm right about this, and I think I've got a reasonable chance shot of being right about this. Again, this is a extrapolation. So when you're extrapolating, you know, sometimes you're going to be right, sometimes you're going to be wrong. Ultimately, I think that the promised land, the Eretz Amar, is the realm of Yah's word. And if you don't like his word, you're going to hate eternity. And if you love his word, you're going to love eternity. It's the land of the realm of his word. Because isn't his word the source of creation? So his word, the land of his word would be the universe. Mm-hmm. The land of his word would be the covenant, the family. It's everything. The land of his word would be the means we use to think. It would be the way that we come to know. It'd be the way we come to relate in a relationship. That's what the Eretz Amar is. It is profound that he used the Hebrew word to declare, to answer, and to promise as the adjective to modify the realm that he is inviting us all to enter. That's the promised land. It's the Eretz Amar.
Was there anything about the Moed Mikris when Larry, like when you read it, and James, when you read about it, that was really difficult to grasp? I kind of picked it up right away, and that's not my heritage. You know, I knew that was
simple and straightforward.
I'm sitting there reading Pesach, and I'm seeing Yahusha all over it. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty obvious to me what was going on.
Well, these are profound things and totally uncustomary to us.
Right.
Americans, and I grabbed hold of it right away, and my wife grabbed hold of it right away, and I'm not saying it's not deeper and we can still plumb the depths of this stuff. I'm just saying I got the message pretty quick, and I'm not
for me it was a little longer, and I'm going to tell you the reason it was a little longer for me is that I really was slathered with Christianity. I had Christianity bad, and so I believed for way too long that the blood of Jesus and God dying on the cross was the means to salvation. And so getting rid of that, but before I could get rid of it, then Passover had to be the means to salvation. And so it took me a long time to jettison the lies of Christianity. And I'm embarrassed to say it. I mean, obviously God can't die. Man can't kill God. Death is not the means to life, nor the means to resolve problems. Matzah is clearly the time where our sins are resolved. I mean, I had it all wrong, and I'm embarrassed to say I had it all wrong, but it wasn't until I was able to jettison, walk away from my Christian past, that I understood that Passover is nothing more and nothing less than the doorway to Yahweh's home and the doorway to life. It doesn't purport to be anything more than that.
I picked up on it right away, just like Kirk, but I was reading Yada Yada. See,
and I had struggled with it for a year.
I had an advantage.
Maybe 2 years before I wrote it down like that. Okay. And I think that's an important conclusion that you just made, Larry. And that is that sometimes somebody has got to go out there and really struggle through it to understand how the pieces fit together. But when it's Yahweh's puzzle that we're putting together and Yahweh's portrait that we're putting together, once the pieces are put together, it's pretty easy to relate to.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, once you know it, of course, you know it. And if somebody's telling you that the blood of Jesus smeared on a pagan instrument is somehow, saving you, of course you realize they've been had and what they're really talking about is a cartoon. It's a cartoon.
Right, and
it's
a
cartoon.
A man whose name they do not know, and they're purporting that man killed their God. And then they're purporting that their God's body was reanimated and that he became a reanimated version of his old body, and yet they can't put the pieces together that would be in conflict with the Torah, and why didn't anyone recognize him? And how did he, with that body, walk through a wall? And how did he transport himself from 60 stadia north of Jerusalem to the upper room in the blink of an eye? Why did he tell the women at the empty tomb who thought he was the gardener, "Don't touch me, I haven't yet gone to the Father"? Did he ever say, "Don't touch me" before?
No.
If they had touched him, they'd been incinerated. They'd been incinerated. Oh, I mean,
it was never
as bad as...
I'm sorry.
By the way, one of the things that really helped was coming to understand what the three days and three nights in the heart of the land meant, that he was, and how that was the only clue he was going to give to the rabbis about
this. And once you see that cardia, and we all know about cardiac arrest and cardiovascular.
Right. The heart of the land.
Okay, that's the heart of the land. And then they want to make the heart of the land a tomb.
Right.
A tomb.
Right.
You
know, the heart
of
the land
is
Jerusalem. I'm going to be in Jerusalem for 4 days and 3 days and three nights. And he was.
Yet we were all told that thoughtful people with years of experience and knowledge put this religious material together. And then when I look at it, it says cardia. He says he's going to be in the heart of the land, cardia eretz. Basically, I'm sitting there going, well, how could they do this to people, knowing full well what he was talking about?
You know, one of the things that really opened my eyes to this whole thing was the realization that if you're a Christian, my God, why have you forsaken me, destroys your religion. Because God can't die if it's no longer God. How could he say before he dies, before his body succumbs, my God, why have you separated yourself from me?
Because the Ruach left him.
I know now what happened. But as a Christian, that's a killer to your religion. And
well, by the way, I thought that where you pointed out, he's saying El in the very next verse. It's Elohim.
I'm going to give you a little nugget there. there's a little nugget there for you. But the thing that was the most profound about that is that he was quoting Psalm 22. And Psalm
right,
22
absolutely.
Provides the most direct, most comprehensive, most accurate rendition of what was occurring right at that moment and what was going to occur over that evening, over matzah, and over Bukkurim. It is a perfect presentation of an eyewitness account of exactly what was going to happen, which is written exactly 1,000 years before it transpired. And so once you make that connection, then all of a sudden you say, oh, now I get it. Pesach is the doorway to life. That's all Yahweh says about it. When he is presenting Pesach to the children of Israel through Moshe while they're still slaves in Egypt, does he say that Pesach is going to deliver anything other than the death of a firstborn son?
No.
He's strictly the continuation of life. That's all it represents, the continuation of life, which is one of the reasons why Yosha couldn't die on Pesach. His body could serve as the Passover lamb, but his soul had to continue because Pesach represents the continuation of life.
Yeah, you're into the doorway, then the next step's matzah, and what is he doing for matzah? Well, Yasha Yehud tells us, his soul, his nefesh, is down there acting as a ransom for whom? The family is
right.
For whom?
Clean us up.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's it, you know,
right.
For
to
the
clean
people
up our
that
record.
Join the covenant. Yeah, yeah. He's
now, is the blood of that sacrificial lamb was to be sprinkled on
the ark.
What object?
The ark. Ark of the covenant.
The ark of the covenant, but in Egypt, where?
On the doorpost.
On the doorpost. So in Egypt, it's on the doorpost, and in the tabernacle, it's on the mercy seat of the ark of the covenant, isn't it?
Right.
So those two things have to be related, don't they?
Yes.
So
I didn't know.
The ark of the covenant. Which is the ark meaning free will. So this free will of the enclosure of the covenant in the doorway that Passover is representing are the same. So maybe it's the doorway to the covenant. Is there any possibility that doorway is to any other thing than the covenant?
No, not even a small chance.
No.
But that's where the Christians stop, isn't it? I mean, they stop right there.
I don't think they get there.
No, they don't.
Represents
they don't
the doorway
what it
to
is.
The covenant, and the covenant is Yahweh's family.
No,
the point is they stop. They stop with the blood on the cross saved them, and all the way through Yahweh's Torah teachings, he's saying, "Stay away from blood."
That's
no accident.
And they're into their New Testament and their New Covenant. But Yahweh's Yosha became the doorway.
The
so Yosha is the doorway. The doorway of Egypt, where the lamb's blood was smeared, that became the doorway to life, and the blood being sprinkled then in the tabernacle by remembrance of this on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant tells you that the doorway is to Yahweh's home. That's it. That Passover is the doorway to Yahweh's home. And once you enter through the doorway to Yahweh's home, you become immortal. Because is Yahweh's home in three dimensions?
No, it's forever.
Nope. No, it's not. No. Because, first of all, it can't be in three dimensions because it is unlimited in time. And Yahweh has made it absolutely apparent to us that he exists as light, as energy, as light. And so he is absolutely, unequivocally, at the very least, in the fourth dimension. So if we enter Yahweh's home, we have to upgrade dimensions, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And by that, with the in science fiction movement, they're always talking about the portals and the wormholes and the portals to different dimensions and the portals to time travel, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Pesach is the doorway. It's the portal to time travel. It just happens that that the only way we can time travel is to be in Yahweh's home, because it's the doorway to the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh dimension.
You know, it hit me extremely hard this week thinking about how futile it is to that we could come back as a human being. How awful!
Oh my goodness! How awful!
And you know, normally you say, "Well, I can come back and you know, and do it again," and you know, no, that's terrible. It is
terrible.
Disgusting. I mean, and where is he going to put you when he makes a new world?
You know,
and how are you going to be in that world if you made a new world? I mean, it's just the whole thing. It just falls apart. I mean, I'm slow.
Yeah, I don't. I want to go to the next dimension, and in the next dimension, this physical body can't exist. It would be it would preclude me from going into the fourth dimension. I can't become pure energy and light in the fourth dimension. I can't be eternal in time with the liability of this physical body. So no,
right.
Passover is the portal
to the
fourth dimension, which is the dimension of time. Now, the dimension of time...
Timelessness, really.
Well, it's not timelessness. It's freedom, liberation in time. Can we say that? There's a slight difference. You know, timeless means that there's no, you know, less time. How about liberation in time?
Okay, outside the normal flow of the rate of time as we know it.
Right. Yeah, and if we're no longer constrained in the ordinary flow of time, if we're not stuck in the flow of time, we are liberated in time, aren't we?
And you could go macro, micro, through anything.
Right, absolutely. So Pesach represents the portal to the fourth dimension. Now, if I'm going to go out on a limb here, and Roy might eat me alive on this. And Roy's pretty good about saying, you know, your extrapolation went too far. And I don't know if he listens to this program. I know that Roy listens to the archives of Shattering Myths. What if matzah represents the portal to the fifth dimension?
Yeah, what if? Could
what
have.
If?
We don't.
And
know.
What if Bukhuram represents the portal to the sixth dimension? And what if Shavuah, where we're ultimately empowered and enriched, is the portal to the seventh dimension?
That could be too.
And what if we're in the seventh dimension, and from there on we become the troubadours, and we participate in the reconciliation of Yisrael and camp out with Yahweh for all time? You see, when Yahweh conceived the universe, whether or not he conceived the dimensions, or dimensions are just part of the construct that he created, and I think that Roy is right, that his word caused into existence the energy that became matter, and within that transition from energy to matter, we have dimensions. We go from just the point to dimensions. Yahweh has to be outside of the dimensions of space-time, of those four dimensions. He has to be outside of them to have created them. He has to be outside of them to be powerful enough and able enough to have created them. So he has to be, at the very least, outside of four dimensions. He has to be in the fifth dimension, at the very least, to have created a four-dimensional universe. That's just a fact. He has to be outside of four dimensions. He has to be, in the very least, in the fifth dimension to have created a four-dimensional universe.
Right. If you created light, you created light. So therefore, you're outside that. Yeah.
Now, remember, I've said this before, and I want to relate to a conjecture that I had. I said that I think that Yahweh created a seven-dimensional universe. I think Yahweh is actually in the seventh dimension. And what I said was that
I... sense. It would make sense.
And I said that I thought that the dark energy, which is repulsive in nature, represents free will and choice, which we will have from all eternity. And I think that dark matter, which has an attractive characteristic, represents relationships, which we will enjoy for all eternity. And I said that it's my extrapolation. Now, I could be completely wrong here, but it's fun to think this way. That what I conjured was that the seventh dimension was Yahweh's word. That it was the very essence that binds energy into matter, that is this transition that created the universe, that created life, that is the essence of the Torah, the essence of the covenant, that it all boils down really in the seventh dimension to the word of Yahweh.
May I?
Yeah.
If it's not that, then I wouldn't believe that it could be something else, because then it would be limiting. If it's
correct.
The word, then he could speak everything
right.
more.
Correct.
But if it was some other type of dimension, my question to Roy that I made a note of is if he is inside these dimensions regardless, or there are dimensions that exist, and he's not on the outside, then is he not limited?
Yeah.
But if it's his word, then that would make then you could buy that.
Right. I think he's inside of the seventh dimension, and in the seventh dimension, I think he actually looks like a brilliant variation of us. I think that the depictions, and Roy has pointed this out, the depictions of Yahweh by those he has invited to see him, who have then conveyed to us what Yahweh looked like when they were elevated to see him, depict him in very human terms, just with, you know, a brilliant, glowing version of us. And what that means is that in the seventh dimension, he's approachable. He's knowable. He's an individual. We can relate
well,
to him.
Well, he says he's an individual.
Right.
He has to be greeted as an individual.
Yeah. We can stand with him, walk with him, hug him, hold his hand. He is, in the seventh dimension, very much an individual, distinct individual in the seventh dimension. And in that seventh dimension, we have an infinite opportunity to grow with him through his word, and we can explore all seven dimensions, including the six that I've mentioned up to that point. Now, Roy is in the same boat that I am. Neither one of us can prove that there are seven dimensions, but both of us, having come to know Yahweh's testimony, are virtually assured that that's the case. I think that as we move through this, we are in a three-dimensional construct stuck in the flow of time, that Pesach is the portal to us being liberated in time, the fourth dimension, and that Matzah is the portal to the fifth dimension, and where we are perfected, and that Bikurim is the portal to the sixth dimension, where we are related to Yahweh. We've made our choice. We are related to Yahweh. Matzah is the deciding point. Matzah is the ultimate essential day that is the deciding point. It represents the fifth dimension, which is choice. Bikurim represents the sixth dimension, which is relationship. And on Shavua, the promise of the Shabbat, the promise of seven, Yahweh enriches us and empowers us, which is exactly what his word does. And that's when we join him in the seventh dimension, enriched and empowered. And the rest of it is we play out the hand. We become his troubadours on Teruah, join him. He brings us into his home on Teruah, and we play our role in the reconciliation. Now, we play a tiny role, but we're in this kind of unique situation, and it's becoming less uncomfortable for me to talk about this. Yahweh has chosen to work through flawed individuals like us. And he enjoys it. He likes working through flawed individuals like us. He does not execute his plan on his own. Is he capable of doing it? Certainly. But that's not the way he works. He prefers to work through us and with us because it demonstrates his whole purpose. So Teruah and Kippurim, we're part of what's going to reconcile Yehudim and Yisrael to Yahweh is what we have made available. I mean, what we made available is nothing but an accurate translations of Yahweh's word and commentary on it so that Yisrael will come to understand it. He chooses to work through us. And so that in the seventh step, we'll all camp out with Yahweh in eternity. But I think there will be a finite number of dimensions because it becomes counterproductive after a while to continue to add dimensions because Yahweh would always have to be in the next. And so I think we're going to be in a seven-dimensional construct, and that Passover is the doorway to liberate us in time.
Isn't that amazing? Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, understand that we can't enter Yahweh's home in three dimensions. Yahweh's home is not in three dimensions. It's at the very least in four. Because he is liberated in time. And so he can't be stuck in time. So you have to have a portal to the next dimension. I think that's Pesach. Because it's the doorway to eternal life. And, you know, that's the first benefit of the covenant. We become immortal. And then Yahweh says, walk to me and become perfect. We become perfect. There's only one path that Yahweh has provided. There's only one path that Yahweh himself walked. You know, the point that I wanted to make, and I don't know if I underscored it enough, but when Yahweh says that, actually engaged and then summarizes on the first of the two tablets, that he led us out of Mitzrayim, led us away from slavery. What he's saying is, I'm not expecting you to turn away from human, religious, political, military, patriotic, economic institutions on your own. Larry, you're the one who has constantly mentioned that when you first do that, it's really disorienting and it's really lonely. And if we were left to do it on our own, I think we would stay disoriented and stay lonely. It would be a good thing to do, but it would be disorienting and it would be lonely. We'd be disconnected. So Yahweh says, I'm not asking you to do it alone. He didn't ask Abraham to do it alone. And that's this very notion that we've talked about in previous programs where Yahweh reaches out to and introduces himself to people who do not yet know him. But then he doesn't leave them. He focuses on them. He walks together with them. It's what he did with Abraham. It's what he did with Moshe. It's what he did with Noah. It's what he did with Adam in the garden. It's what he's done with us.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing that out, underscoring just that. If this is your first time, you know, if this is the first time you're walking into the door at Pesach, realize that, you know, none of us have this thing perfected. You feel like you haven't somehow done enough, but it's not up to you to do really anything other than show up.
Show up.
He provides the party.
Show up with the right attitude, the right perspective.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Don't be show up as a bomb. Show up. Show up. Ready to party, ready to celebrate.
Yeah, ready don't show up with the religious face on, scared to death.
Don't show up
not
being afraid that you're going to do something wrong. It's a party. Don't be a party pooper. Right, show up. And then it's who's hosting his party?
It's Yahweh's party. So
who's providing the only lamb that matters?
That would be Yahweh.
Yeah. Who is provided the benefits for this party?
Yahweh. Right.
All the party gifts are provided by Yahweh, aren't they?
That's right.
Right. The music's provided by Yahweh. The lyrics are provided by Yahweh. The meal is provided by Yahweh. The parting gifts are provided by Yahweh. All we're asked is to show up with the right attitude and have a good time.
Yeah, and what's it for? It's for the purposes of understanding, isn't it?
Right.
He says so. So
right.
Since it's for the purposes of understanding, we're just putting our understanding together. I read and recite that day, and I understand it, and I'm happy, and I celebrate. And that's about all I can do.
Right.
Because everything else was provided by Yah.
And,
so people
and I grill,
need to
I
go
grill lamb,
something.
I get my olive oil, and I put in my bitter herbs, and I get a really good, my best red wine, and at sunset I eat it, and I celebrate it, and you know, every aspect of it resonates with me, and I'm just there to party with Yahweh and to enjoy our relationship. I no longer rely on Pesach for eternal life. It's, you know, one and done. From that point on, it's a celebration of eternal life. You know, and matzah, I don't go to matzah and say, oh, God, you know, please remove religious and political sin from me. It's already done. I now celebrate it as a reminder of what he has done, as to show my appreciation for what he's done.
To celebrate what he did.
Yeah, celebrate what he's done. Yeah, what he's done. Absolutely. And so...
Boy, that's tough, isn't it? Have to do all that.
Yeah, you have to do that. Yeah, it really is. But you do need to engage. He's given us an invitation. If you don't answer the invitation, if you're not thoughtful about the invitation,
right,
then, you know, you're not going to get the benefit. If you're opposed to the invitation, you don't even know... If you don't know the invitation exists, you think the invitation is for other people, and you think that the invitation no longer matters, and you don't think the invitation is from a God you like very much, you know, I'm describing Christianity here, then, you
they
know.
They don't like him, that's for sure.
Yeah, they don't like him. Boy, I don't think there's anybody that knows that better than you, Larry, because when you share Yahweh's words with Christians, they really dislike it.
Pretty much everybody in Unpopular does it, and everybody gets the same cold shoulder, and
right.
And we all know it. You know, it's just that it's. I don't battle them anymore unless they jump in on a post I'm on.
Yeah,
I don't seek them out to fight them anymore because it's just a waste of my time.
It is a waste of time. Now, is it possible to be opposed to Yahweh's words and be one with Yahweh?
No, it is not.
Is it possible to dislike
Yahweh's
testimony and like God?
To do what?
No.
Is it? No, I'm going to say this is profound. Is it possible to be critical of Yahweh's testimony and to like God?
No.
No. So for all those Christians, say, I just love God. You know, I've got this wonderful relationship with God. You know, I praise you, O God. And
we're back into the
completely opposed to Yahweh's Torah testimony. That's impossible because Yahweh and his word are one. If you're opposed to Yahweh's word, you're opposed to him.
He spoke the universe into existence. That suggests, Lisa and I were talking, it suggests, you know, vibrations mean something. Yeah. You know, these words are vibrations. That's maybe making it all come together. That's what a vibration is, you know. And I just, I have the feeling that the reason that most people are never going to peel the scales off their eyes is they're always looking for an advantage. And they can't see the great advantage of really believing what Yahweh said because they have a contorted view of Yahweh.
Right.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, and I think like the fellow that the African American lawyer that I was talking to at lunch yesterday, when I constantly reminded him, I said, "Listen, what I'm telling you is that there is absolutely no question, Paul was a false prophet, and I will give you 20 reasons, none of which you can assail, that prove emphatically that Paul contradicted God and was a false prophet, and therefore the religion of Christianity, which is based on Paul, not on this misnamed person, Jesus, is absolutely false. But if I take that away from you, what you need to know is what you get in return is a God who is likable. He is one cool dude. You just have to have an appreciation for if you discard the religious view of him and get to know the actual God as he is, going to fall in love with him. He is a great guy. He's worth knowing.
And well, no, I mean, it's, I think people are being so excited to actually meet Yahweh. It'll be, you know, that's the whole thing. He doesn't want worship, but, you know, you don't have to ask for praise or worship or anything.
Yeah. But, you know, Larry,
when you're all that, you know.
We've already met him. We've already met him. He is in his words. He's no different.
Yeah.
He's going to be no different than his Torah testimony. He's going to be no different than his
covenant. I've felt him with
me
in debates after debates after debates. You know, believe me, I have. I know that. But
no, I understand.
But to actually
seeing him
in
seven dimensions and us being elevated to the point that we are his children in seven dimensions, I mean, that's going to be an extraordinary experience. And I am incapable of understanding Yahweh in seven dimensions. And it'll be an exciting time, I would agree. But Yahweh is still not going to be any different than his Torah testimony. You know, he's just going to be the same father of the covenant, same dad that likes
to
talk
to
and care and listen and sing and party, have fun.
Yeah, not a religious deity. Sure.
Right. So we're going to meet. I actually think that he is going to be humble. That, you know, our first instinct would be to, oh my God, literally, you know, and he's going to say, yeah, hey, come on. We're going to be buds. We're going to be friends.
Yeah, he even says they're standing in front of me shaking.
Yeah.
Shaking with excitement, as Terry points out. You know, he wrote a note on that. And, of course, they make it shaking in fear.
We are going to shake in excitement.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true.
Yeah, I mean, people are people. And, and we
it
haven't
may take
been
us a while not to,
kind of
to shake in excitement. You know, it may. But eventually, we're just going to become comfortable.
Yeah, because that's how it goes. But there again, that's why Yahweh doesn't ask for anything but respect, and the respect he asks for is same respect you would accord anyone that you thought a lot of. You know, he's not asking to be put on some pedestal. And you know that there is one thing I was thinking about this week, and you know the seven Moed Mikra. The first three were a pretty rough road to walk if you're the one providing the lamb. You know, that's pretty rough stuff. Or the first two.
The first two
were
pretty rough stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, really just as bad as it can possibly get.
Right.
And, you know, I thought, you know, Yahweh could have chosen a plan that would have been a lot easier.
Of course. Except I'm not sure he could. And let me tell you why. I don't think there's any way for him to be just and for him to exonerate us unless he himself is willing to pay the price. I mean, I think that the plan that he came up with is the only plan that where he can continue to be perfect and just.
Well, he is also the creator of the universe, so he can set whatever rules he wants to.
But yes and no. Justice is justice. Fair is fair. Right is right. He can't accept someone who is wrong into his presence unless he has made them right. And if he said this is the consequence of sin, and that consequence isn't adhered to, then he's
being capricious. So you're saying that's right. So rather than breaking his own word, because it's the one thing he won't do.
He can't do that. So the only way that he can be truthful and reliable, trustworthy regarding his word, and not apply the consequence of sin to us, is for him to pay the price himself. No, there was no other choice. This was the only option. It's a brilliant option. It's a wonderful option for us. I mean, but it was the only viable option, I think. I don't think there is any other option. Now, I'm telling you, I'm not smart enough to have conceived it, but I am smart enough to understand it. And, Larry, there isn't any other option. It was the only way for him to be consistent with his word, to apply his word exactly as he stated it, to make no exceptions, and still allow him to exonerate us. The only way he could do it is for he himself to endure the penalty and consequence of our rebellion. That's what makes this plan so spectacular, is that it's not just words, it's actions.
Well, no, it's deeds. I absolutely agree. He's right.
Yeah, it just didn't talk the talk. He walked the walk. That gets right back to the Exodus. Who was with him every step of the way? Yahweh. Every step of the way. He didn't say, I'm going to take you out of Egypt and then, you know, you're on your own. He doesn't tell us to walk away from religion and politics and we're on our own. He's with us every step of the way. That's why that blessing known as the Aaronic blessing that Kirk and I spent so much time on.
Oh, the one we figured out wasn't an Aaronic blessing.
Yeah, that's true. It's a Yahweh blessing. But Yahweh says, you know, you want to bless the children of Israel, tell them these seven things. And the second of the seven is that Yahweh is going to pay attention to us. He's going to stay focused on us. He's going to care about us. He's going to be in tune with everything that there is to know about us. And that's what he does. If you're willing to walk with him away from religion and politics and to his land of words of promise and answers, he's there with you every step of the way. And so that's, we're not walking away from something into nothing or alone.
Right. And, I mean, that's clearly right.
Yeah, and
sure,
one of the things that I've constantly said, and it didn't resonate with a lot of people initially. I think it is resonating with more people now. And that is when people would come to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant, come to know Yahweh as he is, and they're walking away from religion, all of a sudden they were isolated from their family. They're isolated from their coworkers. Right. They were isolated from everybody that they previously had a relationship with, and they were very alone, and they were looking for someone to fellowship with. Mm-hmm. And I would say, why are you looking for someone to fellowship with? And I'm sure I came across as cold. But I said, why are you looking for someone to fellowship with? Don't you have a relationship? The whole purpose of this was to have a relationship with Yahweh. Isn't that good enough company for you? So, you know, I'm going to celebrate Pesach all by myself. Except, it's not going to be just me. It's Yahweh. That's the best company in the world. Best company in the universe.
We shouldn't be disappointed. He's not disappointed.
No.
He's having a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know that some of you have a much more expanded group that you celebrate with, and that's better. That's better. But I'm not alone on Pesach. I'm in the company of my best friend. I'm in the company of my father. I'm in the company of my mother. I'm there with, in the way that matters the most, with other members of Yahweh's covenant family, spiritually. We aren't asked to do this alone. We do it with Yahweh. We're never alone. Once you answer his invitation, you're never alone again. Ever. No matter where you are, no matter the circumstance, you're never alone again. So it is a journey into his family where the Creator God of the universe, because when we become family, he's focused on us, cares about us, knows everything there is to know about us. That's good. So here's the first line, fellas. As we are introduced to Pesach, he says, in addition, Yahweh spoke, and that's Amar. So that's the promise, isn't it? He provided an answer, he made a promise, he made a declaration, all Amar. to Moshe, the one who draws out. So we're not being, he's telling us that the purpose of this word, of this promise, is to draw us out of, and he's going to tell us it's the crucible of Egypt. So it's to draw us out from religion and politics, militarism and economic schemes. In addition, Yahweh spoke as God, El, to Moshe, the one who draws out, and to, now do you think that Yahweh just threw in the second name, Aharon, because, you know, what the heck, God, two names are better than one name. I'll just give you into the details, but that detail doesn't mean anything. Or do you think this combination between to be drawn out and enlightened free will, which is what Aaron means, is important?
Everything is important.
Like maybe he's providing us with enlightenment so that we can use our free will to be drawn out of human religious and political institutions. And that's what his word, Amar, will do for us. I think that's what he's saying right there in those introductory statements. So in addition, Yahweh spoke as God to Moshe and to Aharon, the one who draws out an enlightened free will, and he spoke to them in the realm of the crucible of Egypt. So it's interesting. Yahweh was willing to have his word be in a place that was terribly religious and terribly militaristic, terribly political, for the express purpose of reaching out to those that he wanted to free, to liberate. For the purpose of saying, La Amar, again. And Mitzrayim, crucible of Egypt, Mitzrayim is a metaphor for human religious and political oppression. I don't know if you, have you done all of these words, like Mitzrayim in this particular passage?
Are you on, tell me which verse you're on now.
I'm on Shemot, Names, Exodus 12, 1 and 2.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Is that the one we were working on? Yeah, what,
yeah, it's Mitzrayim is the word. And then for the purpose of saying this specific, Zay is not an arbitrary term. It means this specific month. Ha Kodesh. Kodesh is from Kadash. It means when time of restoration and renewal, and he's speaking of the light on the surface of the moon when he uses Kodesh. I am stunned that there are people who think that we count from a full moon, and yet there's people who do that. When the moon is full, when the light of the sun is across the entire surface of the moon that is visible to us on Earth, at that point, is the light on the surface of the earth being restored, or is it deteriorating?
It's going to be diminishing from a full moon. It
won't
be restoring. And I've never heard of this before. There are people that start to count with the full moon. That's what they're calling a new month?
Yeah. Right.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, a lot.
No, that's the one that just went by you, pal.
Yeah. No, it's when he used the noun Kodesh, which is based on Kadesh, the verb.
Repair, restore.
And the verb means, repair, renew, restore. It's obvious that he's talking about when light begins to be renewed across the surface of the
moon.
Right.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the one wacky group I haven't run into yet.
They're out there. They're out there. So it's your... that this month shall be your first and foremost. So what month is, according, if you're on Yahweh's calendar, what's the first month of the year? Is it January, based upon Janus, the Roman god of doorways?
No.
And by the way, the Janus, the January, the Roman god of doorways, is that not a counterfeit for Pesach?
Oh, it's totally, doorways, sure. Yeah, it's a face looking back and a face looking forward.
Right. So everyone in the world today is using, except Muslims, which are just, they are forever lost. But with the exception of the Muslim world, everyone uses January 1st as the first day of the year. That's when they celebrate New Year's Day, with the exception of religious Jews who celebrate it at Rosh Hashanah, which would
and
be
Iranians who just celebrated it last Saturday evening, I think. They have a thing called Nowruz. That's what it means, New Year. And they actually start in the exact count that we start. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So, Yahweh's first month of the year is tied to Pesach. Now, he gives us all of the insights that we need. He tells us that the barley is Abib at this particular time of renewal of the light on the moon's surface. The barley is Abib,
yeah, green.
And there's a and there's a blue flower on the flax. So he tells us, gives us those two clues so we know what time this is. Barley is the first of the grain crops to bear fruit. And Abib means that the fruit of the barley, the kernel of the barley, is still green, it's still growing, it's still receptive. And that's really important because grain is the metaphor for souls that have grown into, have been incorporated into Yahweh's family. The chaff is that which is tossed away and done away with. The pure kernel is of barley is the soul that is in Yahweh's family. And the only souls that can be in Yahweh's family are those who are still growing, those who are receptive. And Abib is a growing, receptive kernel of barley. And he says, so at this time, the barley is Abib. Well, barley is Abib right around the spring equinox. That's when barley is Abib. So this has to be the new moon closest, the renewal of the first sliver of light on the moon. It's really not a new moon. It's the first sliver of growing light on the moon before the sun sets. You're going to have at least, I would say, a 1% coverage of renewing light on the moon's surface before the after the sun sets for this to be the first month. But it's at a time when barley is Abib and the flax is flowering, which is each year at the vernal equinox.
Now, so, by the way, I had a guy attack me by saying, you guys do Passover at the wrong time. I said, really? Why is that? Because wheat is not ready by then. And I, you know, hey, pal, it's not wheat.
Yeah, they
by the way,
no,
saying
no reference
it's
to wheat. Yeah, no reference to wheat. Now, you know where you get wheat? Why he is misled with wheat?
He's talking about wheat. Separating the chaff when he's talking
No, it's because of the fact that virtually every English Bible, because they were translated out of the Latin into English, use wheat. And they use corn and wheat. And you look up the lexicons and you'll see wheat and corn, because that's what the religious translations did. But Abib is barley. Absolutely, unequivocally, barley.
Yeah,
that's what I've seen.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and that's when the barley. So that's a person who was misled by religious publications.
Right. I mean, yeah. I just don't think you can get anything right if that's
right.
What you're using, especially
right.
English-based Bibles. I mean, they're just
right.
Awful.
Well, what's funny is that person probably spent a ton of time researching when wheat is right.
Yes, yeah, he tried laying that on me,
spend,
as a matter of fact.
It didn't spend 2 seconds to look up whether or not wheat is actually what's being discussed.
Of course. Right. Or to look at barley. One of the things that I've developed an affinity for barley. It is by far my favorite grain. I prefer breads made with barley. I like soups made with barley. I've come to, it's just like my favorite meat is lamb, my favorite grain is barley. And, you know, it wasn't because I was trying to please Yahweh. It's just, that's what I found is the most enjoyable.
Worked out that way. Yeah.
It just worked out that way. Yeah, it worked out that way. So
lamb is a very good meat. I'll give it that. I don't know that I've eaten a lot of barley. I don't know that, but
yeah, it's got the most.
I do eat matzah. So.
Yeah. All right. So it says this month shall be your first and foremost. It's La Roche. La Roche. Roche is named after the Hebrew letter Roche, which is the R. And so when he says it's the first and foremost month, he's talking about the month to be observant, the month to use your eyes, your ears, your mind. That's what this, it's not only the first and foremost month in the sense of it's the first month of the year, it's the month of being observant. That's what Roche means. It's a month, a time of renewal that is the first and foremost time of being observant, and being observant is what causes us to have the benefit of being renewed. And it shall be on your behalf the first month of the year. So is this calendar for Yahweh? Why would Yahweh need a calendar? If you're liberated in time, what? Why would you need a calendar?
For what?
Yeah, for what? So, he doesn't say that that the first month of the year, Abib, is for him. He says it's on our behalf. Why is it on our behalf? Because, as he said in Bereshith, that the greater and lesser luminaries became visible as signs of the meeting times. So this first month is for us an indication that Yahweh has invited us to a party at a specific time. That's why it's for us. And because those parties provide the benefits of the covenant, that's why it's on our behalf. The Mikrae aren't on Yahweh's behalf, they're on our behalf.
I had a Christian woman once tell me the reason she didn't worry about Shabbat is she quoted from the New Testament saying, it's for men. And I said, oh, okay, so something that's good for you, you wouldn't do. Come on.
Yeah.
It's for men. Where does she get that from?
Sabbath is made for man, not God,
not
or something.
Not man for the Sabbath. Yeah, not man for the Sabbath. The Shabbat, while it is Yahweh's, is for our benefit. He created it for our benefit. That's why it's for the benefit of humankind. It's the day where we rest and reflect on what Yahweh has done to settle our debts so that we can settle down with Him. That's what Shabbat means. It's His time of promise. It's His promise to us. It's for us. The promise is for us. You know, the plan of seven is for us. Yahweh already exists in seven dimensions. The formula of seven and of escalating in dimensions is for us. It's for our benefit. That's why it exists here in the Torah. All of this is for our benefit. Now, it's not to say that Yahweh doesn't benefit. He does. But He doesn't benefit from the Shabbat. We benefit from the Shabbat, and He benefits from us benefiting. You mean you follow me? When we do something good for our children, what we do for them doesn't bring direct benefit. It brings indirect benefit because it benefits our children, and our children growing brings us pleasure. So it's an indirect benefit for Yahweh only when we benefit. But all of it exists for our benefit. Then he says, on your behalf, the first time of renewal, Kodesh, of the year, Hasana, time of change. So speak to, speak on behalf of God, to the Almighty, to the entire witnessing community, the Edah. Now, Edah is an interesting word. It's based on Ed. But it's the feminine of Ed. This is not Ed as a name. It's Ed as a concept. Ed and Od are the same concept. Od would mean eternal and everlasting. and vocalized as Ed, it is also testimony and witness. So it is the restoring and everlasting testimony and witness, Edah. But as Edah, it's the feminine of that concept. So what he is saying is that the witnessing community, the Edah, the eternal means for restoration, and the everlasting witness has a feminine characteristic. It's just like Yisrael, it has a feminine characteristic. Just like the set-apart spirit who provides this has a feminine characteristic, maternal. So speak to the entire witnessing and restoring community of the children of Yisrael, Bani Yisrael. Kirk, we corrected what the primarily the Brennan site provides relative to Paleo-Hebrew about the noon, because there is no question as to what the Be'eth means, although I think Brennan truncates it at just home and household, because Be'eth in Hebrew means family.
Right.
And so the first letter in Ben, which is children, sons, is clearly family and home. But the second letter is only indirectly seed.
The nun, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't drawn as a seed, was it?
No, it's a sperm.
It's a sperm. It's sperm, absolutely, unequivocally a sperm.
Right.
And so for Yahweh to have created a letter that is a depiction of a sperm to convey a child with inheritance who is part of the family living in the home, 3,500 years before we knew what a sperm looked like. I don't think it's dumb luck.
No, it's an aha moment.
It is an aha moment. But it's not just an aha moment that it was depicted as a sperm, but that child in Hebrew, Ben in Hebrew, in the pictograph of that word, if you ever wanted a word that proves conclusively that the pictures depicted by the yods and tittles matter, it's Ben.
Yeah.
A child born into the family with an inheritance that's living in the home.
And then it's plural with Ben A, then you've got Yah's hand reaching down again, so.
And it's almost always plural.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just a child with an inheritance. Being part of the family and living in the home, it's them being able to do so because the hand of the Father brought them there.
Mm-hmm. It's very plain.
Right. Yeah, that's what the letters convey. And so this is to the entire witnessing community of the children of Yisrael. And again, we have so many that says, so this is for the Jews. When did he say the entire community of Yehuda?
No.
No, he didn't, did he? And Yehuda is where we is the corruption of Yehuda is where we get Jews, isn't it?
Right.
He didn't say Yehuda.
No.
He could have. He didn't. He said Yisrael. And you know, it's not difficult to put together Yisrael. Ish is the Hebrew word for individuals, which is a powerful term in Hebrew because, you know, this is your favorite, Larry, right up your alley. How does Yahweh want us to relate to him?
As an individual. Yeah.
When Yahweh depicted himself, the set-apart spirit, and Yosha, taking a walk with Abraham, eating with Abraham, chatting with Abraham, looking off yonder in the distance with Abraham, what word did he use to depict his presence with Abraham?
I'm not sure.
I'll give you one guess.
Yeah. Ish. Ish. That was going to be my thing. I was waiting for something really stunning here. Yeah, as an individual.
Yeah, well, that's stunning. Yeah. That is stunning.
Yeah. Well,
because
it is.
I want
really
to be known as an individual.
Initiate.
When he met with Abraham and when he was relating to him, he related to him as an individual. In the covenant, we get to relate to God as an individual. It's pretty profound for me. And here in Yisrael, it's individuals. Individuals,
you know,
Sarah.
Did you know that Yish is also the number 70? There's 60 on the 10 for the Yod, and the SH is a 60. So it's 76 plus 1.
Really?
Yeah.
He doesn't miss
a trick. He's good, ain't he?
He's good, isn't he?
And you don't think he'd be fun to talk to for the rest of your time?
Well,
yeah.
Again, you know, there was a few shows back that you'd mentioned, you know, I might know a billionth of the Torah, and I went the other route, and you said, well, that's being kind. I said, oh, okay. You know, but then you start looking at realizing all the things in the Torah, the little sort of computer readouts that are in there, and every little word and every picture that goes with that word, the meanings of everything, and the fact he spoke the universe into existence with words, which I'm sure
on a 7+1 formula where he did it in 6 days, and on the seventh rested on a 6+1 formula, and that the history of our universe has played out in the 6+1 epochs. And that the week then was devised to memorialize that on a 6+1 plan, with the Shabbat representing the one, which is the seventh day, and that his plan to empower the benefits of his relationship play out over a 6+1 path. And my friends, yes, there are seven dimensions, and we're going to meet Yahweh in the seventh dimension.
Yeah, these are things that we understand, but you get into things we don't understand. I would almost bet you the way to make a universe is in those words. I'll bet it lays it right out. We just don't have the ability to find it. That's what
we're not properly empowered and enriched with his teaching to fully understand it. But Larry, if I'm right about this, we will never fully comprehend it. Because the moment we have absolute and total comprehension, there's no more opportunity to grow.
And he'll be
so I think we're going to spend eternity expanding what we know and expanding on what we understand and celebrating this lifetime of growing together. I don't think we'll ever reach, by design, total and complete understanding. And I don't think it would be any fun if we did.
No, but we might reach total and understanding of the Torah up to now. But the Torah, I mean, it goes on. His instructions are going to go on. I mean, really.
Yeah, I think that we will be privy to, when the Torah is written inside of us, we're going to be privy to a billionfold, probably a 7 billionfold, increase of understanding of the Torah.
And to be able to have that means there's so much we've missed, it's unbelievable. Yeah. We're like cavemen down here. Less,
but I do think that Yahweh is going to give us teaching and direction that's much more applicable to eternity with him in heaven versus the existing Torah. It'll be 100% consistent. It's just that there's no reason in the Torah that he writes inside of us to tell us about the consequence of rejecting him. There's no reason for him to tell us what the consequence is of ignoring him or separating ourselves from him or divorcing ourselves from the covenant. There's no reason for him to tell us that stuff. But there is reason for us to tell us how we can transition from energy to matter when we want to enjoy good food, good song, and a good time around a campfire. I mean, I want instructions on how to do that, right?
Right.
And then to be able to transition back into energy we're going to need instructions on how to do that. And so I think the instructions he's going to give us are going to be applicable to the environment we're going to be exploring together.
Well, I do too. I mean, otherwise, what would be the point?
Right. So it's going to be a marvelous experience. But you're right. We, at this point, every time that we go through anything that Yanawa says, and we think about it, and we apply what we learn, our understanding grows. And we knew enough 10 years ago to present Yanawa and his covenant and his Moed Mikre in a way that resonated with all of us and caused us, to become part of his family. And yet what we knew then 10 years ago versus what we know now, I mean, I bet we have grown more than 100-fold in understanding.
Oh, I'm sure of that. I mean, we weren't even aware that
easily.
The physical body didn't,
right. easily.
Didn't rise.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things.
Maybe 1,000-fold that we've grown over that period of time. But I don't expect that we're going to grow any less profoundly over the next 10 years. I think it's going to be exactly the same kind of continued growth.
That's a positive thing. I mean, that's definitely positive. Hopefully that will be the case. I'm sure it will be. You know, we pick things up here and there.
Yeah.
You know?
So Yahweh then says, on the 10th of this month, which is Ba, in the 10th, Ha, Asor, not just any arbitrary day, on the 10th of this month, this time of renewal, accordingly, to approach La, each individual, that's your favorite word, Larry, what word do you think that is?
Yeah, I got it.
Shall obtain Laka, shall select, grasp hold of, and receive. So we're going to do something here. You know, this is the do part. We're going to
We're going to go get that lamb. Yep.
Shall obtain on their behalf. A male lamb, they say, for himself and his home, La Beth, on behalf of their household and family, a lamb, say, according to their father's households, Beth, families. Family, family, lamb, lamb. The lamb is providing the doorway to the family home, which is being stated there, and this is about individuals. We come into, we transition that portal to the fourth dimension. We transition individually. Yahweh provided the path. He walks with us all along the way. But this is not a group project. We do it individually. Each individual soul has the opportunity to make an enlightened choice.
Well, that's the ultimate free will, though, isn't it? I mean, that's of course. Yeah, it has to be that way.
Yeah. And, I think there are some that came really close, like James, you and your wife, Patty, came to you very close at the same time. Kirk, you and Terry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're also very close to the same time. You guys might even be closer than James and Patty.
Yeah, she said, here it is, read this, and next thing you know, that's all we could do.
Right. Well, she might have beat you by a
million.
If she hadn't handed me the thing, I'd be out there wandering around. So.
Kirk, isn't that amazing? Isn't it amazing once you see the truth, it's so obvious? I mean, really?
The only thing we can figure is you have to want to, because that's the deciding factor. I mean, you can do all this logical thing. You could debate. I could have a conversation with you. I could have been sitting down having dinner next to Yada today and said, this guy's a nut.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't, because I knew a lot of things he said were already true. I mean, that's what helped immediately, you know, that I knew about this, that, and the other. And I said, oh, well, if that's true and the other stuff is true, then I got some real soul searching there.
You know, and Kirk, there's a reason why. There's two reasons why I do not limit yada yada to simply a more accurate and complete translation of his word,
mm-hmm.
and that it has commentary. The commentary is there for a number of reasons. One is to explain the whole process of translation and to explain the choices that were made and to empower people to understand the process so that they're not dependent on me and they can have a conversation directly with God. But it's also to explain the history of these words and how the definitions are derived and how Yahweh presented them. But it's also important to, because the fun part is once you come to know what he said, making connections to other things he said so that you understand. Mm-hmm. But there's also a commentary in there that reveals what these things mean. Like, when, for example, when Roy explained that Yahweh cannot exist and all of Yahweh cannot enter our three-dimensional construct, and he has to be outside of that three-dimensional construct, the first thing that popped into my mind is that exposes Paul as a liar when he said the fullness of the Godhead resided on him bodily. And Roy just laughed at it, but absolutely, it proves that Paul was a liar. That's a connection that's important to make, because when you can make that connection, you help people say, yeah, that's right. And mm-hmm. So a lot of the commentary and yada yada was to say, yeah, you know, it is right. Easter and Sunday and Christmas and crosses and trinities are pagan. They're wrong. So I think that it's important for us to convey that. You know, the Torah doesn't just have that which is right in it. Yahweh takes the time to explain that which is wrong.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, there was a post going by on FB the other day. I couldn't help myself. It was cell or something. I don't know, some genetic mark. It was a cross. It looks like a cross.
Right.
And of course, so then they turn this into, there it is. This is a part of us. You know, and I showed the guy that basically that's the oldest satanic symbol around. You know, and Yahweh never used the term cross, never once. The Latin crux was brought into it. Oh, they talk about falling off their chairs over there. And, you know, I was the evil one, and I think I know so much. Right. And I said, no, you're the arrogant people because you choose copy edits over what's actually there.
Right, and think about how profound this is. The term Edon appears, I don't know, something around 50 times, maybe more, maybe it's 70 times, but 50, 70 times in the Torah. Edon,
the upright pillar.
And Edon is in the Torah. Every time that Edon is used, it describes the upright pillar of the tabernacle. Every time. And it's used throughout the Torah to depict the upright pillar of the tabernacle. I would ask you, what language was Yosha speaking?
Hebrew.
Hebrew. Mm-hmm. So, the Greek word steros, which means upright pillar, it was a translation of what Hebrew word?
Edon.
There's only one Hebrew word that could have been the basis for the translation of steros.
Of course, you see D-N now, and they put Lord there, you know, the daily. They put Lord there, and people actually think.
And when you change Edon, upright pillar, to Adon, then, and Adonai, which puts the Y after it, which makes
that's
it my, my Lord.
Lord.
Right. And so it's like so many Hebrew words that Adon does mean Lord and Master. Edon means upright pillar of the tabernacle. Yosha was speaking of the Edon when he referenced the upright pillar. Pick up your upright pillar, your Edon. You know, grasp hold of the upright pillar. Upright pillar of the doorway to life. Grasp hold of it. But he's speaking of the Edon. He said Edon.
Wow.
And just so people know, we're right on the upright pillar being used. He goes over the fact he hates being called Lord.
Right.
Of course, that's designed to make him a religious deity, lording over people, constantly omnipresent, and all the other nonsense.
And that's presented in Jeremiah. And Jeremiah is the one book in the entirety of the Torah and Prophets that is specifically written to Gentiles. And in that book, he specifically says that one of the greatest crimes that's ever been promoted is the removal of his name and the replacement of his name with the
on account of Baal.
Lord. Yeah, on account of Baal.
Baal, because that was Lord Baal.
That's right.
I know. And then he goes on several other places. Look, if I'm a father, where's my respect? If I'm a lord, where's my something else? You know, he says, you clerics who despise my name. I mean, that's pretty clear to me. You know, you can't be.
Well,
you know,
in Hosea, when he says when he returns, he says the thing that he's going to enjoy most when he returns
mouth.
Is never hearing
the
Lord in their mouth.
That's the one with the, and you'll greet me as an individual.
Yeah, right.
You'll greet
right.
me. That's the one I quote
right.
all the time.
Right.
Yeah, that's
and
the, exactly
and they'll
right.
they'll say, Lord, Lord.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah
when Yosha says, no one who calls me Lord, Lord shall enter the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah,
no
I know, you show them
but Lord,
they don't care.
Lord.
They don't care.
Yeah.
You show them
they
that off the oldest parchment you can find, and you show it to them. You put it right up there, and you put the Bible verse next to us, and then they turn around and they say, well, he's my Lord.
Good luck with that. Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah,
and then to show just how stupid and Christians are and unwilling to respond to what he just said, Yosha then says, then they come back and say, but Lord, Lord.
Lord.
Didn't we do this and that and the other thing? And he says,
and
what
he describes only Christians, by the way.
Right.
Those are only Christians that could be
correct.
Described.
And what does he say to them? That's right. The only one calling them Lord are Christians. And so, and what is he saying? The Christians that did all these marvelous things in his name, that built these marvelous things, that cast out demons and did healings, all this kind of stuff. And didn't we prophesy in your name? And he says, no. I don't know you. Get away from me, those of you who are without the what?
Torah.
Right. I mean, you have to ignore almost everything Yosha said, particularly what's called the Sermon on the Mount, which is the instruction on the Mount. You have to ignore every aspect of it to be a Christian. You have to be completely ignorant of what he said and what he did.
Well, yeah, but even further than that, you have to not care, because I can promise you, and I'm sure you've done the same thing, even what we were talking about in this email with this guy William
right.
was trying to send some
right.
words to.
Right.
They completely shut down. Oh, ha, 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 this is just your concept. Ha, ha, you're... It doesn't matter. None of it.
Yeah, and what they end up doing is they share their opinion, and they present their opinion as if it was a objective debate, that it was an objective.
Oh, and they'll do that. They'll do that while they call you arrogant. You will use his
right.
words, and they will call you arrogant. I've had it happen. And I say, who do you think is arrogant here? Somebody that listened to Yahweh's words or your opinions? And who am
right.
I to believe at the end of it all? His words or you? That's what I ask
right.
them every time. That's usually when they slither away. I mean, they just...
Right. Yeah, this fellow that I was having the conversation with at lunch yesterday, I asked him. So Yahweh says he created, you don't know that name, but that's God's one and only name. He said that he created the universe in 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
And science says that the universe is 14.7 billion years old. Who's right? And he says, well, you know, my belief system and my faith says that it was had to be 6 days. So you think the universe is 6,000 years old?
The correct answer is they're both right.
And he says, yes. And I said, that would be wrong. Because the answer is they're both right. And we went through relativity. And I said, here's the math. Now, if that's not...
Now, what happened there? What happened there, by the way, when you showed him that?
Couldn't process
that
the information. I mean, and that was Roy's comment. Roy, you know, what Roy said profoundly enlightened me. I mean, it resonated with me. It enlightened me. It empowered me. I reacted to Roy's research on a subject I already knew pretty darn well, with
mm-hmm.
great
yeah.
jubilation and celebration.
Right.
And it's because it fits everything that we've come to know. It reinforces everything we've come to know. And yet this individual couldn't process it. It just was beyond him to even contemplate. It was just on to the next subject. But. couldn't process it.
Well, it's kind of a funny thing because that's what they will always do. I mean, not always, but 99.9% of the time, is you've just shown them a very, very insightful, profound...
Yeah, a jaw-dropping moment.
I think it is. I think of all of them it is. It's maybe the most. And you sit there and you show it to them, and they go, okay, well, we're on to the next thing now.
Right.
And I think to myself...
No, you didn't process it. You did not process that realization. And Roy, who is an excellent communicator, told me in an email that he shared this with countless people. And he says, I haven't had a single individual where it's resonated yet. But I will tell you, for those of us who are part of Yahweh's family, I don't think there's only one thing that's happened in the last year where I've gotten more enthusiastic letters from people. People, love Kirk's attention to the letters and what like Beth and Nun and Child mean. People really like that. They just say, that's just easy to understand. But across the board, everybody responded in our family to the benefit that we all gained by Roy's research and presentation. And yet, when he presents that same information to religious people, it means nothing to them. They just immediately reject it and don't even want to think about it.
But why? Why would that do it? I mean, I understand what it meant to me, but why? I mean, they're the ones who want to find Noah's Ark and everything. I mean, they're just right before your eyes, 6 days.
Right.
This is how you prove it.
Right. And of course, Noah's Ark. You can use Google Earth to find Noah's Ark. I know exactly where it is. And most of you have probably used Google Earth to look at Noah's Ark, and it's exactly where Yahweh said it would be, in the mountains of Ararat. And yet, they want to go off and prove Noah's Ark when they want to reject the Torah that the story of Noah and his Ark is presented in. That gets right back to, I'm so focused on the detail that I don't understand what any of it means.
Well, one of the things that always got me, and I've mentioned this before, is him painstakingly telling us the dimensions. And I never understood why until I understand that those dimensions rival our most advanced ships today.
Right.
You don't have to find the Ark when you have the dimensions if you've got a mind.
Right.
You know, I want
to tell you one of the great aha moments for me when I found that Yahweh's testimony said that it was a great upwelling of salt water, of seawater, that began the deluge. And then after translating it, someone sent me a note about the Berkel impact crater. And it's the same time, and it would have created exactly the event that Yahweh is talking about. And you go, all right. This is really
tough. And now what are the odds of all this being a big accident? And you know, I was talking to Yalda this week, and I said, you know, Yalda, if I had a map here that showed you how to get to the $1 billion, and you knew for sure it was there, I know you would spend all your time doing just that.
Yeah.
And you'd get to that $1 billion. I said, well, you know, this is well beyond $1 billion. We're talking.
Yeah, this
talking
the Torah is the map to the wealth of the entire universe.
Universe. Yeah, you're
beyond
talking
it.
About. Yeah,
beyond
know,
the wealth of the universe. The universe is trivial. Yahweh is going to destroy it and create a new one in our presence. That's how valuable
that.
What we're inheriting is.
I mean, it's shocking. I mean, we're talking about. You know, people would invest their entire lives to go on a treasure hunt. I mean, that's an example. You've seen people do it 40 years on a treasure hunt.
Right.
And then they may come up empty. They may not. But, you know, there's big expeditions put together that go on for years to find a bunch of doubloons or whatever.
Right.
And yet these same people who claim, and most of them claim, I believe in God. Yet, you know, you give them a map to meet him and to find, you know, instead of having a certain amount of something in one man-made construct that really comes down to nothing when you get right down to it, money is not much. You know,
hey, Larry, does a map provide direction?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it does. Does a map provide guidance?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Is the Torah a map?
Yes, it is.
Are there paths put on maps?
Yes.
Are paths typically depicted on maps? Yeah. And is there a path in the Torah?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So is that the Torah just
a map
to the covenant? And when
yes,
you find the covenant, don't you inherit the greatest treasures in the universe?
That's right. You do.
Yeah. So for the last 10 years or so, haven't we all been on using this exact same map to go on this great treasure hunt?
Indeed.
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And you know what's so amazing about this treasure hunt? That when you find the treasure is constantly learning, constantly growing. The treasure isn't silver and gold. It's knowledge and understanding. The most valuable treasure.
It's relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, the treasure chest is the Ark of the Covenant.
And a deeper, James said, a deeper friendship, a deeper love, family relationship.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, fellas, we've done not an hour and a half, but 2 hours and some change.
Have we?
Yep. Yeah, I know it's been fun.
Wow.
I'm going to rank
them all. Get your time together over there, Chart.
Yeah.
You know, we're 2 minutes
my wife
over.
Wants it a while.
I want to say this has been this has been one of my very favorites. We've had a lot of 2 hour discussions that have been fun. This is one of my very favorites. I want to thank you guys for making this Shabbat before Pesach so special. And you know, when we next meet, we will be celebrating.
Yeah, now are we going to do a Pesach show or not?
Well, we started a Pesach show.
I need to be on the same page.
We spent most of the night talking about what Pesach represents is the doorway to the fourth dimension, the doorway to life, the doorway to
I guess what I'm asking is Friday, are we going to do it? The third. That's when I start. You know?
That's when I start.
Yeah.
Yep.
We'll be on the air as Pesach begins.
Yes, exactly.
I can't wait.
Well, thank you for letting me be in. I appreciate that.
Oh, hey, Kirk. you're great. I think that this is one of the few circumstances where the different personalities and kind of proclivities of the four of us, which we're very different individuals, I think it works really well together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. One of the things I'm going to do if I'm on the air...
Yes.
I have a shofar that I play at sundown.
Uh-huh.
I do it at every mikra. I mean, I play. Pretty
there
good.
There you go.
You know,
that alone.
Not bad.
Yeah, that's the shofar. I just played it for you.
Cool. Scared my dog.
Sorry about that. That was
okay. Sorry, that's always fun.
That's not bad. That's not bad. But you know, there's an actual one. I want you guys just to hear this a second. Sounds of the shofar. This is the one I do, and it's really nice. Here it is. I'll turn my little speaker up here.
That's my favorite. I know of that one.
These guys are good.
I really like that. Yeah, that
awesome.
One that reverberates through my entire being.
Oh yeah, it's an awesome. Yeah. It's the sound of the shofar. It's on YouTube is where I always.
You know what it does for me? It makes me contemplative. That's what
it probably does me too, but it's just an awesome way to ring it in. So that's
I understand that you know it rings it in, and that's the purpose of it. But when that is playing, I'm contemplative. Immediately I move to thinking mode. Yeah, focus and thinking mode. It's powerful the way that it reverberates in the And then, and I'm beginning to make the connections. The Yahweh with El as God and Ab as Father, both begin with the ram's horn, which is the shofar.
Yeah. Wow.
And the shofar was to alert us to a message, and to warn us. And so it's those connections that scream in my head when you're playing that.
Oh yeah, me too. I mean, it's just absolutely beautiful. Like, these guys are good, though. I mean,
they're good. They can play it. They can play it. All right, guys. Well, good night. Happy Shabbat.
Happy Shabbat.
Fun doing it with you guys. I've had a wonderful time. Celebration of family.
All right. Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. Good night, y'all.
Good night.
See you next week.
Bye.